Good afternoon to everyone, and welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage interventional radiologist, Dr. Eric Maurer. Why don't you join us as we discuss some of the newer approaches to varicose veins and other disorders of the veins, particularly the lower extremities, sometimes clumped under the heading of venous insufficiency. To reach us with questions and comments, you can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And during the next 50 minutes or so, you can email us at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Maurer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Thad. It's great being here.
Since I got out of training over 30 years ago, the whole field of radiology is really, in my mind, has exploded, and we've mentioned the term interventional radiology already today. So would you put this into some perspective for us? What all is going on in radiology, and then really help us understand what the term interventional radiology is and what you do?
Sure. Interventional radiology is a subspecialty of radiology. Radiology is about a five-year residency program that we do after college and medical school. And then you can go out and practice radiology after that time, or you can choose one of the seven different subspecialties of radiology, and interventional radiology is one of those. It's a subspecialty that is much more procedure-oriented than the other subspecialties in radiology.
So you're catheterizing veins and arteries and things primarily with the interventional efforts?
Right. The we use needles, catheters, guide wires, other medical devices, and one aspect of it that separates it from other specialties is that we use image guidance. And when I say image guidance, I'm talking about using things like ultrasound, fluoroscopy, X-ray, CT, or MRI to help guide us to the right locations and placement of these devices.
So primarily it's kind of a way to address disease in arteries or veins rather directly under some kind of specialized viewing system. Is that right? And if I'm right, then give me some example of something that people might understand.
Sure. Probably one of the more common things that we do are to treat blockages in arteries. So as people age, you develop peripheral vascular disease and you get a narrowing in your artery, and then oftentimes it's in your leg, and you, as you're walking, you'll feel some pain in your leg, and we'll do an angiogram and find the narrowing, and then access the artery, pass a catheter, guide wire, and subsequently a balloon into that area, stretch it open, and oftentimes put a stent in to keep the blood vessel open. So that's just one kind of simple example of one of the many treatments that we do. And we pretty much access just about every organ in the body in various ways to do things from clearing blood clots from vessels, opening blockages, treating tumors, spinal insufficiency fractures, just a wide variety of things. And one of the interesting things about interventional radiology is that it's a constantly evolving subspecialty where we're using techniques that we've learned in the past to address new problems in new ways. And the idea is to do things minimally invasive so that patients don't have to go through a big surgery.
Yeah, so the big advantage of these is that all of these issues that you've talked about before, if they were addressed, were usually some kind of open surgical technique, which required general anesthesia and so forth. And most of these are not requiring that and may allow you to walk out the same day?
Correct. Most of our procedures are done with some pain medication or what we call conscious sedation. And most of them don't require general anesthesia. Probably one of the most significant new procedures that I can think of that we're currently doing is to treat aortic aneurysms in a semi-invasive or non-invasive fashion, where treatment of an abdominal aortic aneurysm surgically is a pretty big procedure. We can do it with catheters and guide wires and sheaths now, and patients can get out of the hospital within a couple days.
Mm. Yeah, that is really amazing to me. I want to come back and ask you a question about the technologies that have allowed us to do this, but let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One. My guest today is Dr. Eric Maurer, and after a little bit of discussion here about interventional radiology in general, we're going to concentrate on some disorders of the veins and the lower extremities and what's available to help and really kind of offer some cures, it sounds like to me, to some of these issues. But if you've got questions or comments that come up during the program today, 550-8433 is our local number. That's 550-8433, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And over the next 50 minutes or so, we'll be at Line One, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at KSKA.org, if you want to email a question. So to me, I can remember the beginnings of all of this, where people were slowly beginning to introduce catheters into some very large vessels. And then that's really developed extensively, I suspect, since there's now various shapes, equipment, and sizes, and coils of different catheters, and then now you're ultrasounding or ablating and doing things at the ends of these catheters. Can you tell us a little bit about that kind of technology?
Well, the technology is really quite amazing, and it changes nearly on a monthly basis with what's available. Miniaturization of some of these devices is really what has brought some of these technologies into use with, minimal impact on the body. And the device industry has really helped us significantly. The imaging technology has also improved significantly with time. And then new research is probably one of the biggest aspects of radiology that I think has helped us. Our professional society is the Society of Interventional Radiology. They have a really great website, and you can Google that just by doing Society of Interventional Radiology. And it has a good description of what interventional radiologists do, some of the new procedures that we're doing. And the nice thing about that society is they really have focused in on research. In the past, interventional radiologists kind of moved in where there was a problem and we had techniques to fix things, and we did it, but oftentimes not always backed by research. And now I think that's one of the big changes in radiology and interventional radiology, is that we're able to prove that these techniques work in the short term and long term.
So you're looking at safety and efficacy, which is something we kind of stress all the time on the program, is you're trying to get some basic science or data behind the ideas of what's safe and how effective these procedures are.
Correct.
So the Society of Interventional Radiology was not one of the websites I put on our web links. I think Kristen Spack, I would bet, will do that for us. And so we'll add that to a list of websites. If you want more information on the topics today as well, you can always go to kska.org/line1 and find those links. So let's move on then and talk a little bit about venous disease. And I always like to start with kind of the fundamental basics. If you talk to us a little bit about the basic anatomy and function and the purpose of veins, so we understand what the diseases are a little bit better.
Sure. Yeah, that's a very good place to start, because oftentimes people do confuse the difference between arteries and veins. Arteries are high-pressure blood vessels that carry blood away from the heart to all the organs and tissues in the body, and the veins are the low-pressure side of the system carrying the blood back to the heart. And veins come in various sizes, from the microscopic capillary level to up to 2 centimeters in size. They drain from the top and bottom into the right atrium of the heart. Veins, just to go on to the physiology of veins, they are a main conduit, but they're also a storage system of blood, where your body can store blood when it needs it for various ways. So they have a big storage capacity, which they can increase in size and decrease in size. And what can happen with veins? They can clot, and they can become dysfunctional or dilated, and that's basically what varicose veins are. They're dilated veins, and they can be either very small veins like telangiectasias, which are only 0.5 millimeter to 1 millimeter in diameter, up to varicose veins, which can often be 8 millimeters in size or larger. They can become enlarged and tortuous. And varicose veins are a result of venous hypertension. So it's not necessarily the vein itself oftentimes, but the increased pressure that happens when we stand up that can cause some dysfunction of the veins and venous reflux. Venous reflux being an abnormal direction of blood flow in the vein.
So you'd have, for example, a large artery supplying blood to the lower extremity, all the way down to your toes, and then that blood has somehow got to get back up your body against gravity most of the time. And you haven't mentioned the valves, but the valves are an important part of this that allows that blood to kind of work its way back up under, because there's not as much pressure driving that blood back to the heart. Is that part of the issue?
Yes. Thank you, Thad. The valves are a very important part of the function of veins. One way to look at it is that the valves in the veins are similar to, and I've heard it referred to this as the peripheral heart. Without having a valve, when you squeeze the vein, all that pressure gets translated back down to the toes if you don't have a valve that helps push it in the correct direction.
So without that blood getting back to the heart for whatever reason, then there's extra blood in those veins, and then we begin to have some symptoms of some sort?
Right. Just to go back one more time to the physiology, which is important with varicose veins, there are 2 levels of veins in the legs. The deep veins, which are a very functional part of bringing the blood back to the heart, and then the superficial veins, which are above the fascial layer. And those are the veins that typically get dysfunctional and result in the venous varicosities that we see superficially. There are interconnecting veins that do communicate between the deep veins and the superficial veins. And the deep veins can also become dysfunctional and have venous reflux as well. But as of right now, there's not that much that can be done about deep vein reflux. So what are the symptoms? People complain of aching, heaviness in their legs. Usually that's worse at night and after exercise. People can have ankle swelling, brownish discoloration if they have chronic venous insufficiency. Sometimes there's complaints of redness, dryness, itching, cramping. When these symptoms get worse, you can have delayed healing. If you have an injury to your leg, the skin can occasionally atrophy and thicken. Later on, people can have scar-like plaques in their legs from chronic venous insufficiency, and then ulcerations are kind of the ultimate bad dysfunction of the veins. Occasionally, people will have varicose veins that do chronically bleed as well.
Is this primarily a disorder of aging? And I guess a corollary to that question, is it a natural occurrence with aging?
Aging is certainly a big part of varicose veins, and it's probably that as we age, some of the elasticity of the veins decrease, and you get collagen deposition in the veins, and they become dysfunctional. And as the veins get a little bit harder or more dilated, the valves in the veins are no longer functional, and that just escalates the problem.
We remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection, and we're talking about vascular disease, particularly peripheral venous disease. If you've got questions or comments, 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. And we'll be here for the next 50 minutes or so. If you've got questions, then you can email us or call us. And then also remember, you can listen tonight from 7 to 8 on kska.org if you'd like, or if you'd like to have somebody that you know would like to listen to it, you can always go and do that. And it's available as a podcast. Also, you can listen at any time at kska.org. How common are these disorders that at least causing enough of a concern to wish somebody to go ahead and have something done about it?
Well, it's thought to be quite common, where at least 20% of the U.S. population has some form of symptomatic lower extremity venous varicosities, and 10 to 35% may have some form of chronic venous insufficiency. And I was surprised to read that approximately 4% of people over the age of 65 have venous ulcerations. It's estimated that there's about 4.6 million lost work days related to vein disorders at a cost of over $1 billion per year.
We've mentioned age, I guess, is a risk factor, and I'm thinking that it's also maybe more common in women, and I might be wrong there, so I don't want to be sexist. You need to correct me if I'm wrong, but let's talk about other risk factors besides age.
Heredity is probably one of the biggest factors. Most people that come to us complaining of venous disease like this say that their mother had it, and they have other family members. So heredity is a big factor. It is more common in women than men, although men are quite affected as well. Pregnancy does tend to be one of the risk factors for developing varicose veins. Women can also have ovarian vein venous disease that can end up causing some pelvic venous congestion syndrome, which then can be seen as varicose veins also in the lower extremities. There are many theoretical reasons for also causing varicose veins, and that's mainly things that lead to increased abdominal pressure. The Western diet is one of the issues that has been described, things like prostatic hypertrophy, where you're straining during urination. Any sort of straining activity that increases abdominal pressure can lead to increased pressure in the lower extremities. Constrictive clothing of the abdomen can lead to some increased pressure. People have said that leg crossing and sitting in chairs can lead to increased risk factors for venous disease. Occupations where there's prolonged standing. Question whether or not obesity is related to venous disease has been brought up, but I don't think there's any real data that shows that it is. But again, anything that increases abdominal pressure can lead to venous disease. Other chronic medical conditions, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, have also been associated with venous disease.
You know, I was thinking one of the things you didn't mention, although you mentioned the opposite, was standing for a long time. I was thinking that if people are less active, that there's less muscle contraction, and the muscle contraction in the lower legs may help propel or increase pressure and get the blood back out of the extremities. Is inactivity or lack of exercise an issue?
I think lack of exercise probably more so than inactivity. If you picture someone sitting on a couch, they're probably not having so much trouble getting blood flow back mm-hmm. to their heart. Whereas if they're standing, but maybe not using their actively contracting their muscles, mm-hmm. That may be an issue. And if we have time at the end, we can talk a little bit about deep venous thrombosis, because that is a concern, particularly when you're doing prolonged traveling, such as air flights, where you're sitting, you're not contracting your muscles, and you are pooling your blood in your lower extremities.
So I'm visioning that what's happening over time is, for various reasons, these blood vessels are beginning to have more pressure in them. That stretches those vessels. As the vessels stretch, then the valves are no longer functioning so well, and it leads to progressive, almost an exacerbation of the problems, and that leads to these surface vessels that become tortuous and look irregular. And is that kind of an oversimplification of what the process is?
I think that's a good good visual of okay. what's going on with venous hypertension, venous reflux.
And the natural history I like to talk about, so if these are left untreated, then you get less and less and less real good circulation, and that leads to breakdown on the skin with ulcers eventually, is the things you talked about. So for many people, pain or ulcerations, it leads them to want to do something.
Right. Yeah, the question when you should address having any sort of treatment with your veins, and it's unpredictable which patients actually progress on to have more significant issues such as some of the skin changes and ulcerations. In general, venous insufficiency and venous reflux does not improve with time unless some of your risk factors are modified, such as not standing as long, maybe wearing compression hose, improved exercise, loss of weight. Some of those activities, I think, may somewhat modify the natural history of it. But in general, once you have a vein that's been dilated and lost valve function, it's hard to get that back.
Okay. We do have a caller. Let's go ahead and take her call. Nicole, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. I had varicose veins at a pretty early age. I started getting them when I was about 15 years old, and I was a distance runner at the time. I ran about 10 miles a day cross country, and I'm 30 now, and I have quite a few of them, and I'm also a pilot, and I wonder about having, varicose veins, whether that puts me at a greater risk for a DVT.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a good question. And in general, I would say that it doesn't put you at any extreme risk, but it is said that about 20% of the people that have superficial thrombophlebitis, which means basically a clot and inflammation in one of the superficial veins or varicose veins, about 20% of those people do have end up having deep venous thrombosis. So it can put you at some risk. I think if you're a pilot and you're sitting and flying for prolonged periods of time, I would certainly recommend wearing some fairly aggressive support stockings, which I would recommend for just about anyone that does a lot of traveling. I have a set that I try to wear when I fly, because once you have a clot in a deep vein, it is difficult to get rid of it.
Yeah, I just started wearing those. That was a recommendation from a sibling of mine, so.
Nicole, hang on just a second. Let me. You mind if I ask if there's much of a family history? Since you started, you were pretty young, it sounds like to me, and you were exercising, and so it raises the question, maybe there was some genetic predisposition, something else that was out of your control. Is that been something that's been a family history problem or not?
Yeah, everybody in my family has, on my mom's side of the family has them. Several members have had larger ones removed. Just the old-fashioned way, I didn't listen to the whole program, but with the not the more modern way they removed them. But it runs in the family, and I was pretty healthy. I've always been, you know, right at my ideal weight. So I and I've always been active and healthy. But, yeah, it seems like everybody in my family has them, and I started getting them from junior high on, so.
And if you don't mind, I'm going to ask one more question that gets us into a little bit more depth into the deep venous thrombosis, is that there are now, and again, I'm a pediatrician, so I'm not as familiar with this, so I'm asking Dr. Maier to make some comments, but we've now recognized, since I've been in training, a number of genetic predispositions with how our blood does clot, and some people just seem to have an increased risk for those kinds of things. And so when you ask about your risk, that was one of the things I thought about. If there was a strong family history for these deep venous things, then it might be worth us mentioning that you can screen for those kinds of risks now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right. Well, and typically people don't just go out and have themselves screened unless there is a family history of significant venous thrombosis, or if you are a young person that does develop a deep venous thrombosis without any significant predisposing factor. I think certainly those people should have some of the blood work done to make sure that they're not that they don't have one of those hereditary clotting disorders.
Yeah, we're pretty healthy. Nobody in the family has ever had any sort of problem with DVT or stroke or anything, really. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's good.
No kidding. I actually, an acquaintance of mine at 45 had a DVT. She was a pilot, and he killed her. So I've always been on the lookout for that. So.
Yeah. When those kind of things happen, it, nowadays, I think it does raise the question is what's different there, and it may be not just being a pilot, there may be more to it.
Okay. Those long haul flights, I imagine so.
All right, well, thanks for your call, Nicole.
Thank you.
Line one, your health connection is what you're listening to. If you've got questions or comments, our number locally 550-8433. Our email address is line1@kska.org. Eric, let's take one more kind of just general question we've kind of beat around with a little bit before we take a halftime break here, and then we'll, after that break, talk about treatment a lot more. But what about prevention? It doesn't sound like to me that there are a lot of preventative things. And maybe I shouldn't say that. We talked about exercise. We talked about a little bit about weight and some pressure hose. But are there other options or things we should be talking about?
Other than changing, whatever risk factors you can, and wearing support stockings, if you are someone that does have varicose veins, not an awful lot, I don't think, you can do to prevent this type of disorder.
I'm getting the feeling this is pretty much a genetic thing. Do we know that for a fact? Or, I mean, it just seems like there's a strong family history and... the other factors are hard to control.
Well, I think sometimes it is hard to figure out what is hereditary and what is not, unless it's been specifically studied. And it's certainly probably the biggest, quote, risk factor, I think, for varicose veins.
Okay. Yeah, you'd said that at the beginning. It usually was a family history of a hereditary problem. All right. Well, let me remind everybody once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. After this short break, we're going to continue to take calls and emails and talk with Dr. Eric Maier. This is Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're talking to Anchorage radiologist Dr. Eric Maurer. We've talked a little bit about interventional radiology, which is the specific pursuit or specialty that's addressing these venous insufficiency issues that we're talking about today. You can email your questions to me at line1@kska.org. That's until about 3 o'clock today. Or you can give us a call at 550-8433. Or our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, you're welcome to listen to the program as a rebroadcast from 7 to 8 tonight, or go to the website, kska.org, and listen at your convenience. But we can only answer your questions during this this program when it's live. Let's talk just briefly about the approaches therapeutically to these disorders we've been talking about, Eric, and then we've got a couple more phone calls and an email we'll try to get to.
Sure. Well, just to go back slightly, treatment options are either conservative or active, and the conservative methods are to treat some of your predisposing activities or risk factors, leg elevation at the end of the day. You know, most of us like to put our legs up, and the use of compression stockings, and really you need to think about, if you have significant varicose veins, using at least what they call class 2 or class 3 compression stockings. And most of those are basically prescription grade. They come in different lengths, including calf length, thigh length, and then a pantyhose type of stocking, and it's not always well tolerated by everyone, the degree of compression. It's between 20 and 50 millimeters of compression is what you would need. Anti-inflammatory medications are sometimes used for people that have leg pain chronically from venous insufficiency. So what are the more active ways of treating varicose veins? And historically, varicose veins have been treated back to the days of even before Hippocrates, where they did various treatments, which oftentimes are not that much different than what's been done in the past, including Hippocrates describes taking a metal iron instrument and traumatizing the vein to cause a thrombosis. And that's essentially what the treatment methods are now, although, you know, much more sophisticated. Back when I was doing my interventional radiology training, most of the treatment of venous reflux disease was being done surgically, and vein stripping of the greater saphenous vein was kind of the mainstay of treatments. People that didn't want to go through the stripping procedure, which does carry with it a fair bit of morbidity and a fairly big surgical procedure, would undergo different forms of sclerotherapy, either in the smaller veins, or people would try to do sclerotherapy of the greater saphenous vein. Another surgical technique was a high ligation, where they'd make a small incision near the groin and basically try to tie off the greater saphenous vein. That procedure had a fairly high recurrence rate. The stripping procedure did fairly well, but fortunately within the last 10 years or so, we've come up with these new endovascular, endovenous treatments of treating the refluxing vein. And the typical vein that we're treating is either the greater saphenous vein, which runs along the medial thigh, or the lesser saphenous vein, which runs along the posterior calf. And the varicose veins typically come off of these larger veins. So the procedure that came along about 10 years ago was to advance a catheter and a wire from the bottom part of the vein to the top part of the vein, and then introduce some form of device that deposits energy in the vein. And the two main types used right now are either radio frequency or laser ablative techniques. And the basic idea is to place this probe in the inside of the vein, try to close the vein around that device, and then heat the inside of the vein until it sclerosis. And so with this new technique, you don't have to actually remove the vein, but you remove its ability to reflux. And it's extremely effective when the anatomy is correct for that type of treatment. There are still some surgical procedures that are done now for treating these varicose veins, some treatments of the perforating veins, and what we call ambulatory phlebectomy for patients that basically have a cluster of veins that where we still do hook surgical removals of these veins. And in general, that's not needed to be done as much as it has been in the past because of the other newer treatments. Sclerotherapy is another treatment that's done to treat some of the residual veins that are still there after treating the main refluxing vein.
In this, I guess before I answer a number or phone calls that we have, really this has become a really exciting part of the treatment, the options for treatment of these things, because they're so effective.
That is correct. And in fact, as a part of radiology, we used to do different screening techniques for the surgeons when they were going to decide whether or not they would do a stripping procedure, and it was really not fun to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with greater diagnostic techniques, with better ultrasound, and now more active treatments, it really has become a very exciting part of interventional treatments.
Okay. Well, let's hope we get some time to talk some more about it, but let me go ahead and take a couple of phone calls. Jim, you're on line one.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call, Dr. Woodard. Question, I have some pretty significant varicose veins, primarily right leg issue, although left as well. Certainly a family genetic perspective from my mom's side. My brother doesn't have such. Question becomes one, I also parachuted for a number of years for the Forest Service as a smoke jumper. Did I environmentally exacerbate things beyond the genetic perspective by simply the force of hitting the ground over and over and over?
That could very well be. Maybe not so much from the force, but as you hit the ground, you're probably straining a lot, and just any sort of straining mechanism does increase the pressure in the veins. So you probably did in some fashion increase your risk factors there.
Kind of a follow up then. Also, being active through the years, several broken legs and so on. Does that further then move one in the direction of a greater propensity towards varicose veins?
I do think that's true as well. Any sort of trauma. I've seen people that have gotten kicked by a horse and they have localized varicose veins right nearby where the horse kicked them. I think any sort of trauma to your legs can predispose you to this type of process.
I suppose then lastly, I'm in my mid-50s, relatively good shape. Try to exercise, mostly walking now. Is this indicative of something I need to get addressed other than, you know, it's not a vanity issue, but just certainly something in terms of circulatory?
Well, I think, you know, it just depends on the symptoms that you're having and whether or not it's affecting your life. Some people will be escalating their anti-inflammatory medications because their legs just bother them all the time. And in doing so, you could increase your risks of other problems such as bleeding or kidney disorders from taking some of those anti-inflammatory medications. So you just have to put every person's symptoms in perspective to decide when's a good time to think about doing something about it.
I do experience the tired leg syndrome you've spoken to. Also have a very pronounced, or my right leg specifically, will fall asleep and then a spasming issue where it goes into uncontrolled spasm. Is that related or something not related?
No, that certainly can be related. As these veins dilate, they do cause pressure on nerves, causing pain, spasm. So yeah, that certainly can be related as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah,
thanks for your call. Anne, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a good friend who has factor 5, the blood clotting genetic issue. I was wondering if the radiation therapy would be a good option for her.
For treatment of factor 5 Leiden disease? Or
For doing the varicose vein she has.
Certainly if her...
Because surgery is very difficult for her. She's not really cleared for much there.
Sure. If her main problem or one of her problems is venous reflux, venous insufficiency, and some of the symptoms that we described earlier, then the fact that she has a factor 5 Leiden disorder doesn't make her not a candidate for the treatment. She may be certainly somebody that's predisposed to getting a DVT or having a superficial thrombophlebitis that extends into the deep system. Anybody with one of those clotting disorders really needs to watch their risk factors, mainly for getting a deep venous thrombosis.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call. Where can people go? We have an email here that suggests where can people go to get these worked on. So who do, yeah, I guess the question in my mind, just to help flesh this out a little bit, who all is doing this kind of work? We see advertisements on TV nowadays and in the newspaper. What kind of advice can you give to people who are considering getting this kind of therapies done?
Sure. Well, there are a couple different groups in town that offer these treatments, and not just interventional radiologists. I have a good friend that's a vascular surgeon that does some of these treatments, and a few other people in town. And what I would recommend is just talking to their friends, finding out if people are satisfied with where they've had this done, and to just get information about it, talk to the different groups and decide what program looks best for them, just to get the best advice.
Are there qualifications that people should look for that may give them a little bit more reassurance that at least the professional has had the training to do these?
Yeah, there's not really a the American College of Phlebology is a resource, but they don't offer any qualifications basically to people for doing these procedures. I would just recommend that you always seek someone that has appropriate training and has a good track record.
Okay. Another email is right back to basics again. He says, what are varicose veins? How do I know that I have them? Maybe we haven't fleshed out a visual description of what a varicose vein is yet for someone. So can you paint us a visual or a mental picture?
Yeah. You know, not everybody that has visible varicose veins necessarily doesn't have venous reflux or venous insufficiency. So the fact that you may not have have visible dilated serpentine serpiginous veins, it doesn't mean that you don't have or aren't predisposed to having venous insufficiency. But you know, most people that really have significant venous varicosities, they kind of know it. These veins are dilated after you're standing up. They're pressurized. You can see them. You raise your legs, you don't see them anymore. But it also depends on people's skin type, whether or not you see these veins. Some people have thinner skin or lighter colored skin, and you can see the bluish tinge of the veins. But about the only way you can know if you can't visually see these varicose veins, whether or not you have venous reflux, is it to actually have a diagnostic venous ultrasound.
And that gets back to the symptoms of a lot of swelling and pain, discomfort, maybe skin changes in the lower part of your extremities is the other symptoms that you might look for.
Right. And, you know, certainly anybody that has a chronic skin ulcer of their lower extremity ought to have that evaluated. They can sometimes be from arterial insufficiency, basically on the other side of the pathway, but a venous ulcer is a significant medical problem. It can be very well treated with treating the venous reflux, and is an extremely gratifying thing to do is to have somebody with a venous ulcer that's really life-limiting, and you do the laser therapy on them, and that ulcer just goes away.
What about diabetes as a risk factor? We haven't talked about that, and is that something that's amenable to the treatments you've mentioned, particularly with an interventional radiologist?
Treatment of diabetes?
The diabetic vascular disease.
It's sort of heading towards a different topic. Most of the vascular disease that we see in diabetics is related to the small vessel arteries.
Okay.
And sometimes they'll have larger vessels. Usually it's arterial system that can be treated with angioplasty and stent. But I think diabetes is probably a risk factor for venous varicosities, but not really directly related.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners once again, you reach us over the next several minutes about any questions you have about venous insufficiency or varicose veins and their treatment. It's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, LINEONE at KSKA.org. Brian, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I work in the healthcare, and I actually stand on my feet almost 12, 14 hours a day. And my family history, my father had it. I started to having it at the age of 18, and the superficial veins have been quite a bit problematic on my left leg. Primarily no pain, but itching and a few ulcerations. Dr. Mara talked about the thermal ablation. What are the risks of it, and then how successful are they over a long term?
Yeah, good. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. The risks of doing the laser treatment are actually rather low. There's a small risk of causing a deep venous thrombosis when you do the procedure. It's probably in the neighborhood of 0.6%. We've done probably thousands of these procedures and never had a significant deep venous thrombosis. So I think it is a risk, but a small risk. People can have a potential infection at the site where you where you enter the vein, and that's also thought to be quite low. If you did get an infection during or after the procedure, that could be treated with antibiotics. Again, I haven't seen that as a significant risk. It is described that people could have a temporary or permanent paresthesia, which is a loss of sensation in the skin above where the vein is being treated. That's thought to be about 2.1% or so, and generally it's just temporary, and you'd have a patch of skin where you just touch it and it's numb, and that's probably because one of the cutaneous nerves ran very close to the vein that was being treated. It generally doesn't cause any problem, and again it is generally temporary. A superficial thrombophlebitis can happen after doing one of these procedures. It's basically what the procedure is trying to do. I'm actually encouraged when someone's more extensive venous varicosities do clot off, because it means that they are treated. The effectiveness of the treatment is quite excellent. When the procedure is being done with the right anatomy on the right patient, about 20% of the people can have recurrent symptoms after having one of these thermal ablations, and that's just because the body has an amazing way of kind of regenerating itself. In this case, not in the right direction, where they would occasionally have other veins that do pop up. Oftentimes those can be treated with sclerotherapy, or we also have a new laser device, which is basically a miniature version of the greater saphenous vein laser, and that's used for treating these perforating veins that come in between the deep veins and the superficial veins. And most people that require that perforating vein treatment do have some level of deep venous reflux.
Just last question is, how long is the recovery period? Are there any other pain associated on a longer term? Can one go back to work within a short time?
Right. Usually the morbidity associated with the procedure is really quite low. You know, we recommend that people take a day or so off work. We like them to wear their support stockings for a period of time after having the procedure done. It just increases the success rate. But yeah, you really only need to take off work for a day or two.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Brian. Good luck.
Thanks.
Sue, what can we do for you?
Hello there. I just tuned in, so if you already covered this, I apologize. But what I'm wondering about is my brother, who's in his early 40s and is not overweight, has for some years had kind of a bulgy, purpley-looking vein at the back of his knee and at I would say the back of his lower thigh, and we call it a varicose vein. It's pretty unattractive, and again, it's kind of big and bulgy. But what I'm wondering if it's unsightly, but are there any actual health risks associated with that?
You know, having a localized venous varicosity is probably not... doesn't have any significant risk. It is an area of blood pooling, which could, if you were on a long flight and you were predisposed to blood clots, you could form a blood clot in that vein, which could propagate then to a deep venous thrombosis. But the likelihood of that is probably pretty low.
All right. So then it sounds like other than maybe that slightly increased likelihood of a clot there, that there's no real health aspects associated with it?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling, Sue. All right. Let's take Robin. Robin, you're on line one.
Yes, I was wondering. My varicose veins get worse when I am pregnant, and they're visible when I'm not. But I was wondering if there was, do I still need to get treatment even when they're not as bad?
No, not necessarily. As we described earlier, pregnancy is a risk factor for varicose veins and venous reflux. And when you're pregnant, you have increased abdominal pressure, and that's why these veins pop up. The uterus presses on the inferior vena cava and decreases the blood flow back. So oftentimes people do have leg swelling and veins pop up when they're pregnant, and then after delivery they go away. So unless there's any symptomatic reason to have those addressed, you really don't, just because you had them when you were pregnant doesn't mean you necessarily have to have anything done about them.
Yeah, I guess my question was they're still visible, but they're just not as bulging. They're still there, but they're not as bad. So I just wondered if I still needed to treat them, and they're not painful either.
Yeah, so. It doesn't sound like in that scenario you need to have anything done. It's all based on symptoms and other risk factors, I guess.
Okay, thank you.
So we're kind of getting to this issue, which is what I hear her asking, is a little bit between cosmetic issues and real physical symptoms. A lot of people are concerned about it cosmetically, and that's a borderline that's getting crossed back and forth a little bit more frequently in medicine.
It is, and in general, insurance companies don't like to pay for cosmetic procedures, so the procedures that we're doing are generally not done for just cosmetic reasons.
I've got one of our listeners that calls in quite frequently, sending an email just asking about contrast that's used, especially in MRIs, a little bit off the subject, and the need for kidney function tests before certain procedures. Do you mind just commenting briefly on that?
Sure. Yeah, it is off topic a little bit. There is an entity that has been described in patients with chronic renal failure if they receive gadolinium contrast material for MRI, and it's a dermatosclerosis that can occur after receiving gadolinium. The risk is extremely low. It's basically non-existent for patients that have no known kidney disease. So in general, unless you have a known kidney dysfunction, you generally don't have to be tested before receiving gadolinium.
Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us, Dr. Maurer.
Thanks, Thad.
Next week, we're going to be back, and we're going to be talking about sports injuries and sports medicine. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack helped us today by engineering the program. Thanks for listening, especially to those of you who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.